and it's Monday, January 30th, 2012, Theories of Knowledge. And I was just answering a question. I was just answering a question about posting. And the question was, well, first there was a problem with posting. Someone was having a problem with connection errors, and probably what's happening is you're spending a long time to type your post, and then your connection is not going anywhere. And so Moodle says, oh, this is like an idle connection that boots you off if you don't do something for a while. So sometimes if you leave it, I don't know what the if it's half an hour or what it is, but if you sit on Moodle with one page there and don't click on something for like half an hour, it says, oh, here's an idle connection. This person's going to have to log out again. And part of it, sometimes they do this as a safety feature because like people go to the library, they get into Moodle, they're in their account, and then they forget to log out and leave and someone else has access to their account. Sometimes it's just the default setting or whatever. So to avoid losing your work, type it in WordPad. If you're on the Mac, text edit or Microsoft Word, and then copy, and you want to paste. When you paste it, first you want to save it as plain text, or you want to use this paste special command, and or paste without formatting. And so what that does, if you either save it as plain text or paste without formatting in your browser, that will make sure that your post doesn't have a bunch of garbage characters that are going to annoy me and everyone else. So as far as a connection error, just send me a Moodle message and tell me what was going on, and and then post again, and I'll mark your post manually.
Okay.
So
send you a message then, and then I can post again, try to repost again.
Yeah, actually, I want you to post again, and then send me a message after you post it, because I have to like see that it's there, then I have to go back into the grade book to mark it after the deadline.
Okay. Thank you.
So. But that's good advice for everyone, you know, though, especially if you're typing something that's 200 or 300 words and it's being you're being very thoughtful and coming up with great ideas and inspirations. You know, do not trust in temporary memory. Back up your hard drive too. That's a good idea. But above all, you know, don't type anything. Don't trust anything in a temporary memory that you're going to spend more than 2 minutes on, because otherwise you're going to be kicking yourself in the keister when it goes away, when there's a power failure or a connection error, or you hit the wrong button, or what have you. And I speak from experience. Although I haven't lost too much. I think the most I've lost is like a half an hour, but I was really angry at myself for not doing that. And after that, I was very careful about, type it in a word processor, save it every few minutes. A lot of times your word processor will have a setting that will save it automatically every 10 minutes, so always good practice. Another thing you can do if you're working on a paper is to save drafts periodically and save it with a new name each time. That way if you decide that, you know, you change something, you're like, oh, wait a minute, it was better the first time. You have that old version you can go back to and use that. Okay, so on to philosophy. One more piece of business, which is an announcement, which is that the test closes this coming Wednesday at 7 o'clock. Arrived at lab by 6 o'clock at the latest. Let's see, are there other announcements? I think we have another one of our Islam scholars coming this week. I think on Thursday. I'll post an announcement in the forum. I think it's 5:30 on the main campus, but I'll post that to the social forum. Okay, on to Barclay. Anybody have a question they want to ask about the midterm before we move on to Barclay?
So it's going to be covering just the first and second chapter, the introduction, and the first half of the empiricism?
Up through Locke. Up through and including Locke. Yeah.
Do you have to do the practice exam?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope, it's not required, and you don't get credit for it.
Okay.
So it's just for your benefit. Although, you know, it is if you take it, you know, you just, like, there's five bubbles to click, and if you take it, you might learn something about questions which might actually be on the exam. So they're based on questions which might even appear verbatim on the exam. So it might be useful to look at that, but it's not required. And it doesn't add to your points. And also, you can take it as many times as you like. So if you get one wrong, you can go back and try again. And I don't think it tells you which one you got wrong, so you have to sort of guess which one you got wrong. Yeah?
I didn't catch what you said. When's the deadline?
Wednesday, 7 o'clock.
All right.
George Barclay.
First thing, Barclay is pronounced Barclay. I'll probably be incessantly correcting students. Think of it as Barclay, like bark like a dog, right? Barclay, not Berkeley. Berkeley is the name of the university in California. It's pronounced differently. Barclay is a Scottish, but he's British, right? So he's one of the British empiricists. And if you go to a town in Britain, which is spelled like this, how is that pronounced?
Berkshire.
How do you say this?
Berkshire.
How do you say this?
Berkshire.
It's actually Berkshire. It's Berkshire, right? So again, it's a funny pronunciation, English. You know, someday when we're all speaking Esperanto, all these problems will go away, right? So my brother's still working on his Esperanto. I think it's sort of a hobby. I don't know, he might delude himself to thinking that it'll be a language that's used. Actually, English today is the lingua franca, which, you know, French used to be the lingua franca, right? That's why they called it lingua franca. And someday maybe it'll be Chinese. But in the meantime, we're stuck with English, and it's Barclay, Berkshire. So remember, Barclay. And, you know, the next time you're at a cocktail party, you want to embarrass yourself by referring to the philosophy of George Berkeley. So, everyone will say, oh, what an ignoramus. And then you won't be invited again.
I don't know what kind of cocktail parties you go to.
Ones with a bunch of philosophers. I had this old professor who used to give these examples. I don't know whether he's kidding or not. He was just talking about how you didn't want to embarrass yourself at a cocktail party by getting this or that basic thing wrong. I did hear a... I did hear a secretary try to order a book by Albert Camus that made me chuckle. But, you know, she just works in the office, so... Anyway, so it's Barclay. Barclay is famous for his slogan. I won't make you remember the Latin, but it's to be is to be perceived. To be is to be perceived. So I want to take a shot at what this means. To be is to be perceived. Yes, sir.
Does that mean that you include yourself, that you perceive yourself by being?
Well, I think that it does. I mean, it doesn't say that you. That's not. That's more like you're. I think you're thinking of Descartes. To be is so you perceive yourself. Then you're. If you can perceive yourself, then maybe yourself exists. But it's something about, like, what it means to be. No. To be or not to be, that is a question. When Hamlet's talking about that, what's he talking about?
Decision.
Talking about whether he wants to kill himself, right? To be, to not kill myself, or not to be, to off myself, because my life is miserable. He says, whether 'tis nobler to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, right? Or should I just kill myself? Right? Yeah.
So I find that to be is to be perceived as something that's more to. I mean, it gets into like understanding that God is the one perceiving the being. That's why it's in existence.
Like, yeah. God actually comes into it, but in this slogan, I mean, it's part of his theory. God's like really important, but this is something, I don't know if it's more basic, but it's God isn't necessarily part of the picture here. I mean, God's part of Barclay's theory, but it's not necessarily implied in this statement here. To be is to be perceived. What is to be? When Hamlet's talking about to be, he's talking about what he wants to exist anymore, right? So what happens if you put to exist is to be perceived? What does that mean? Well, X exists means X is perceived, and Barclay will say by some mind. So, in other words, here's like the sort of common sense, what most people would say is common sense, right? I'm looking at the tree. Go back to the tree. I'm perceiving the tree in the quad. There is a real tree out there in the external world of matter. My senses pick up light waves, and maybe there's some like a sweet aroma of pine coming into my nostrils. Maybe I reach out and hug the tree, and I feel its rough bark caressing my skin.
Can we lick it too?
What's that?
Can we lick it too?
I might like eat a pine cone or something like you'll give us, right?
Now it looks like the tree's really small.
Here comes a pine cone into my mouth. Right? I might hear the rustling of the branches as the wind goes through it, right? And all these things work together and they create sensation. My sense organs pick up all these disparate senses and I get an idea of a tree in my mind. I'm conscious of an idea in my mind of the tree, which represents the real tree out there. This is the old, right, representationalism. Here's what Barclay says. There's no tree out there. The only tree is the tree in your mind. That's it. And actually, this tree in your mind is coming from, and here's where God comes in. And what you're perceiving with your mind is the mental tree that God's producing. There's no real tree out there. Or to put it another way, the real tree just is the tree in your mind. The tree you perceive. Right? Locke says what you're aware of is the tree in your mind, but this tree in your mind is being produced by the tree out there in the real world. Barclay says there is no real world apart from the tree in your mind, that the real tree is a mental tree. The real tree is the tree which is the object of consciousness, the tree you're aware of. So that's, you know, sort of Barclay in a nutshell. That to say something exists means that something is an idea in some person's mind. So another one here. X is an idea in some mind. Okay, kind of weird, maybe. This is the whole question of is there mind independent reality? And you know, Barclay would say no. This comes into when we were talking about relativism, where people would say, well, if you believe it, then it's real for you, right? Or if you think it and feel it, then that's your reality, well, Barclay's sort of hitting on this kind of idea that the relativists have, that if you perceive something, then you're perceiving that thing is real to you. And there is no objective reality. All there are minds and ideas. Or, to put it another way, I suppose, the objective reality is just mental in nature. That it's your mind has certain ideas in it, and that's all there is. And what Barclay says is matter is a philosophical corruption, and it's an idea created by atheists to try to make people think they don't need God anymore. You know, Barclay was actually a bishop, and so as part of his view, he's saying, well, you know, these atheistic philosophers, they cooked up this idea of matter, the stuff that's causes all your sensations. Well, God's the creator of all, and so God is responsible for your sensations, not this material substance that was invented by the philosophers. What do you think so far? Questions about what Barclay's view is, I suppose, before criticism. Anybody have problems wrapping their mind around this? Or about what Barclay means when he says, to be is to be perceived? Yes, sir.
So is he essentially saying that reality is between you and God?
Yeah.
It's a personal reality that's generated by God?
Well, so here's the weird thing. Barclay's kind of ambiguous about, you know, do we perceive the same ideas? Same ideas. And there it's like, so... is it that God sends the idea, and then we have three different people?
Question.
Sort of seeing the same idea. So here's the idea. Here's God. Is it that three different people are perceiving the same idea, or is it that God is sending separate ideas to Mo, Larry, and Curly? Do each of them get their tailor-made ideas?
Yes.
So is it like borderline relativism there? Or
it does seem kind of relativistic. This looks more relativistic than this does.
Right.
This one just says there's an external world, not of material objects, but of mental objects that we all perceive. I think that Barclay seems to go more along the lines of this because he talks about like this idea of perceiving in one place I think he talks about like a plate. You're looking at a plate and you move the plate around and you get all these different ideas. So like think about the different a vantage point of you have like the plate, right? Well, to people looking at it like top down, it's going to look like this. But the people who are looking at it from the side, it's going to look like this. And then if you're like way back in the end of the room, you know, it's going to look like this. And if you're kind of in the corner, sort of off to one side, it's going to look kind of oblong. And these are all different shapes. And Barclay says, well, how can all these different shapes be part of the same object? Because the object's just got one shape, right? Yeah, that. Hylas will say, yeah, of course, every object has one shape. It can't have, like, a bunch of different contrary shapes at the same time. So either it's circular or it's you know, sort of straight like a line. Okay, yeah, I agree with that. And then he says, well, but what about that plate over there, you know? What shape is it? Well, it's round, right? And he says, well, like, you know, hold it like this. What do you see? Oh, it looks like a straight line. And then he says, well, you know, so you're saying that it's both, like, a straight line. It's both straight and curved at the same time. That's kind of crazy. And so it seems like when you think about something like perspective only makes sense if you're thinking about an objective world that can be seen from different vantage points. But Barclay wants to say perspective is sort of an illusion created by your false belief in material objects. And all there really are is a bunch of different shapes. And God's giving you these certain ideas. And that
So Barclay's believes in the Matrix, then.
Yeah, essentially the Matrix or the Arch Deceiver, but instead of the Deceiver, the Deceivers are the philosophers. because he says that what in your experience tells you there's a world beyond your experience? Nothing, right? You have to have some philosopher, tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, how do you know that what you're perceiving is the real world? And then you're filled with all these doubts, right? How do I know? I'm looking at the table, but how do I know the table's real? And Barclay is sort of, you can think about Barclay as being a direct realist. He actually attacks this whole idea of representationalism. He says, how can you have something which is fleeting and ever-changing represent something which is stable and unchanging, right? So he says, if you think about this supposed material world, it's supposed to be stable and unchanging. But if you think about the idea world, or the mental world, let's say mental, it's fleeting and ever-changing. Think about all the ideas that come and go in and out of your mind all day long, right? Thinking about this, thinking about that, one idea leads to another, ideas are coming in, ideas are going out, your mind's sort of wandering, you're thinking about different things, you're perceiving different things. All these things are coming in and going in your mind with extreme rapidity. But so that's like the mental world. The physical world is supposed to be the sort of stable, concrete world that doesn't change it with your perceptions. But he says, how can something which is stable and unchanging be represented by ideas which are fleeting and ever-changing? It would be like if you're going to represent the concept of speed. Suppose you had like a new sports car and it goes 200 miles an hour and it's really fast and it could go from 0 to 60 in 4 seconds. And then you decide, what are we going to call it? I know, we'll call it the turtle. Oh wait, no, we'll call it the snail. And that's what's going to represent our super fast car. And he would say, it doesn't make any sense. If something's supposed to represent something else, that it has to share qualities. And so your mind can't represent something stable with something that's unstable and constantly changing. That was one of his arguments against representationalism. For Barclay, what you see is what you get. There is no real table hiding underneath your sensations of the table. The real table is just the sensations of the table. That's what a table is. A table is like a hard, squares thing that you put stuff on. It's not, item made of material substance composed of atoms and molecules or some sciencey thing that we can't sense. Yeah.
I was just curious. Barclay's whole argument was against the infinitum. Is that right?
Substratum.
Yeah, substratum. How right. One thing is supported by another.
Okay, that's the argument. Yeah, that's his. He has an argument against the concept of substance, and it's an argument ad infinitum. And the idea is that if you assume that substance is that which supports qualities, that you have like an infinite regress where you have to have one substance supporting another, going to infinity. Yeah.
So with that said, I mean, mathematically, we can prove through like fractals, for instance, that we do have an infinite degree of support down to the finest point, and it just doesn't ever stop.
But then what's supporting like the whole thing? Going back to Locke's idea of the world's, picking on the poor old Indians, like, the world rests on a giant elephant. What's holding up the giant elephant? It's on a broad-backed horse. What's underneath the broad-backed horse? And Locke says, something I know not what. And Barclay says, well, something's got to be holding up everything. And so if you say that you need substance to support qualities, because qualities can't just sort of be supported on their own, then you end up having a substance that's that. But then what supports that substance? Well, something else has to support it. Another substance, it's what supports that. Another substance, and then going on to infinity. But it's like the idea that, if you have like a chain hanging in the air and you say, well, what's this chain hanging on? And you say, well, each link is hanging on the link on top of it. And you're like, well, but what's holding up the whole chain? The person would say, oh, there is nothing holding on. The chain just goes on forever. And just in some respects, that's an absurd idea. You think if the chain's hanging there, it's going to be hanging on something. See what I mean? The whole idea of support, if support goes on for infinity, you know, and there's no sort of foundation that's supporting the whole thing, why do you need support at all?
So God is that support?
He's saying that there is no such thing as substance because it leads to absurd consequences. Okay. So the argument is, so Locke says substance supports qualities. Substance, so this is, again, this is Locke in the person of Hylas, in the dialogue. Substance is that which supports qualities. And he says, what does it mean to support something? To support is to be spread out under. To be spread out under is the quality of extension or size, having size, occupying space. But extension is a quality, right? Size, shape, extension. Oops, with the S. Extension is quality. Which itself must be supported. By another substance. And then, you know, off to the races, right? So we got the
room here.
You have quality, and it's got, you have substance that's sort of spread out underneath it, supporting it. The substance here has the quality of extension, and so quality of extension. So it's got to have substance too, supporting it. But then you have to have that. This substance has extension. Oops. So you have to have substance 3, and it just, you know, goes on forever to infinity. So the substance has a quality of being spread out. Oh, being spread out, it's a quality. We need a substance to support that quality. Okay, that second substance that has the quality of extension, we need another substance to support that quality, and just keep on going on forever. And there's something kind of weird about this idea of an infinite regress. Usually it's thought that if you have an argument that leads to an infinite regress, you've gone wrong someplace. It's kind of like if you're writing a computer program and you get into an infinite loop and it keeps on repeating the command over and over and over again, and, you know, maybe cause your program to crash or whatever. And it says, go, you know, you have a computer program that says, you know, go to 20, and line 10 says go to 10, right? It just keeps on going back and forth, and it doesn't do anything, and it goes into a loop, and then your program just gets stuck. And, like, arguments can get stuck that way, too. If they go into an infinite regress, it's thought something's wrong there. So he says, get rid of the whole idea of substance. It's full of these paradoxes, right? That's the basic idea. that, okay, if you believe in substance and you define it as that which supports qualities, let's see where that leads. Oh, it leads to an infinite regress. Well, there really is no support, just an infinite regress of substances. Okay, that's got to be wrong. So therefore, get rid of check your premises. Get rid of your original premise that there is this thing called substance, which is hiding underneath all the sense qualities of objects. And just recognize that what an object is, it's just a collection of qualities or sense properties. So, what is a cherry? Red, round. Sweet, object. Red, round, small, sweet, object. And by object, he just doesn't mean like a material thing. He just means redness, roundness, sweetness, smallness, all those characteristics of the cherry. You put all those sense properties together, that's what a cherry is. And when someone says, I want a cherry, are they talking about molecules? Are they talking about, some theoretical world of material substance? No, they're talking about they want something that's, red, round, ripe, and delicious to eat. That's going to produce certain sensations. There's no real cherry apart from all those sensations. And of course, all our sensations come from God. So, I asked this question. So, Samuel Johnson once tried to refute Barclay, and he went up to a rock and kicked it and said, I refute him thus. So, what do you think about that as a refutation for Barclay?
It's not very effective.
Yeah, so what would be wrong with that refutation, or why might it be kind of weak? Or what might Barclay say in response?
He was able to perceive that.
Yeah, where's this real rock of material substance, right? Of course, Barclay recognizes a rock there. It's like, what is a rock, though? A rock is just like this hard, heavy thing, right? The heart, it's, what is there to the rock other than the sensation you get when you kick it with your boot and the observation of motion of the rock as it rolls little ways? It would... Suppose there's like a runaway coach and Barclay's in the middle of the street crossing. Is he going to dodge out of the way? What do you think? As that is sort of another argument of Barclay. Look, Barclay, you don't believe this really. Because imagine there's a runaway coach there. You're in the middle of the street and it's coming right towards you. What do you do? You say, oh, well, that's the coach doesn't exist. It's not made of material substance. Why do I have to work? Why would he dodge out of the way? But most normal people would say, oh, look, there's a real coach. It's going to flatten me and I'm going to jump out of the way. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that as an argument against Barclay?
It is because he can perceive it, right?
Yeah, but he's saying that what it means to exist is just that he perceived it. What? How about this? How about if I say, okay, well, look, the coach is coming towards me. I say, oh, no, coach... I'll just close my eyes, right? If I don't perceive the coach and the coach doesn't exist, then I won't get run over.
There are other methods of perception, including the coach running you over.
Okay, I still might hear the coach, right? I still might hear the clop clop. So what if I close my eyes and I pull out my handy dandy ear stoppers that I use every time I hear something that I don't want to exist. And I plug up my ears, I close my eyes, and then what happens?
You don't know the difference because you just got ran over.
Yeah, I suppose. But then suppose the coach doesn't finish me off. I'm laying there after I've been mowed over. Yeah, I got some broken bones and internal injuries. And
you have a different perception.
Yeah, but doesn't that prove that there was a real coach?
Well, it proves that there are real qualities that he receives.
Yeah, so that, I mean, what do we mean by real coach again? I'm just talking about more sensations, right? Sensations of pain, sensations of blood, sensations of instead of looking down the street, he's looking at the sky, right? He's got sensations of blueness instead of sensations of building and so on. And what are those buildings? They're not like things made of material substances. They're certain shapes and colors. So just more sensations. And Barclay also says all your sensations come from God. So it's sort of like in the Matrix, right? That God, he says, God set up the world with these certain laws of nature such that you have cause and effect. But it's not cause and effect between material objects. It's cause and effect between will, your will, and certain ideas. So if you use your will and make a decision to jump out of the way, it'll be followed by sensations of, you know, a coach wishing by you. If you close your eyes, you'll have sensations of darkness followed by like sharp sensations of pain. And that's just the way that God, you know, set up the world to allow you to learn and, you know, become a perfected saint and so on. But there's nothing about being run over by a coach that shows a world independent of your sensations, nothing more to that than any other sensations you might have, right? It's just the same as a rock example. It's just more sensations you're talking about. Yeah.
But what if the thing that hurt him was like something that he never saw or heard or perceived coming? Like, what if he got stabbed in the back, he never saw what did it, he never heard it coming, he had no perception of it until it was actually stabbing him? How could it hurt him if it wasn't real or perceived?
Well, I think that if I decide that I want to stab someone in the back, then because God allows free will, he's going to give that second person a sensation of a stabbing sensation in the back, right? Because you think about what are all these things, like my body is just a collection of ideas, right? The knife is just a collection of ideas. But all these ideas are related in certain ways. So if I decide to stab someone in the back, I have, you know, I use my will to produce certain ideas, and God sends certain ideas to that other person. I give myself ideas of stabbing, and God sends the person sensations of being stabbed. Yeah.
So is it kind of like saying that God set up the design of his plan for your life, in a way? Because everything is coming from him, everything that you perceive.
Does it work both ways? I mean, how's it? I think you might say, how's it different from people that think that God has a plan for your life right now? Here's what Barclay would say. Well, Locke, you believe that God created the world with these laws of cause and effect, with material objects that cause all these sensations in our minds. I'm just cutting out the middleman. I just say that God created the world as a sensation that we all directly experience. What's the difference? The difference is there's no proof for this external world of matter that you're trying to promulgate, and also that it has the adverse effect of turning people into a bunch of atheists. And so it's contrary to both reason and religion. And I don't think that Barclay is just making a religious argument too. The religious argument is one of the only one tack. But the other one is, okay, Locke, prove that matter exists without referring to sensations. And Locke says, well, you know, I can't. Sensations are the only way we're aware of the material world. We're aware of the material world through our sensations. And Barclay says, well, that's kind of a complicated explanation. Why not just say you're aware of the sensations? And as a good empiricist, how is it that you, Locke, are trying to advance a belief in something which can't be perceived? Because you can't really directly perceive matter, you can only perceive qualities, and then you infer that there's matter underneath those qualities. And that's what Barclay is challenging, is that inference. He says, Locke, if you're going to be a good empiricist, you have to restrict yourself to what can be seen, tasted, touched, smelled, and heard. And that's just sensations, because you can only perceive sensations. You can only hear sounds. You can only see colors and shapes. Where is this material substance that you're talking about? You look at a couple of places in the dialogue here. You can see this interchange between Hylas and Philonous. So Hylas represents the view of John Locke, and Philonous is Barclay. And notice also that Polonius recognizes that most people are going to think he's nuts, right? He doesn't think, oh, well, of course it's my idea, you know, everyone's going to accept it. He recognizes that people are going to think it's sort of extravagant. But he says, look, the only reason people think I'm nuts is because they've been suckered by the philosophers into believing this concept of matter.
It's not crazy. It's not crazy.
There you go. It's like, the only reason you think I'm crazy is because you're crazy, or you've been seduced by these crazy philosophers. So this is on page 91. How about the same page numbers as you? Oh, this is I think it's the same. So this is the first dialogue, second page, a few sentences down. Hylas says, you were represented in last night's conversation as one who maintained the most extravagant opinion that ever entered into the mind of man, to wit, that there is no such thing as material substance in the world. And Polonius says, that there is no such thing as what philosophers call material substance, I am seriously persuaded. But if I were made to see anything absurd or skeptical in this, then I should have the same reason to renounce this that I imagine I have now to reject the contrary opinion. Okay, well, that's kind of a complicated sentence. Basically saying that, hey, that's what I believe. There's nothing skeptical, absurd about that. But I'm open to reason if you want to try to show me that it is skeptical or absurd. And actually, you have this argument back and forth where he says, what do you mean by skeptic, Hylas? And, you know, Hylas says, well, it's someone that, like, you know, doesn't want to believe in things. And he says, well, so who's the skeptic? Is the skeptic one who denies something or supports something or doubts? Or what do you mean by skeptic? And then Hylas says, he then that denies any point can be no more said to be in doubt of it than he who affirms it. Okay, so he says, how can you say that I am a skeptic because I deny what you affirm? So basically he's saying a skeptic isn't somebody who just doesn't believe in anything. Because you could say, you know, I believe in, this is like people, you call someone like a skeptic. You don't mean they don't believe anything. You don't. I mean, a skeptic is a person who who sort of doubts generally. But Polonius says, I don't doubt everything generally. I'm just doubting this concept of matter. And it seems like a pretty doubtful proposition to me. So this whole idea that I'm some skeptic that doesn't believe in anything isn't true. Let's see. So you get this question, what do you mean by sensible things? So I just get Polonius says on page 92. Shall we therefore examine which of us it is that denies the reality of sensible things or professes the greatest ignorance of them? So they get to this question about who is the skeptic? Who's denying the reality of sensible things? And Berkeley is going to turn around and say that it's you, Locke, that are denying the reality of sensible things. So they have this question, what do you mean by sensible things? And Hylas says, well, those things that are perceived by the senses. Okay, so far so good. And so Philonous says, are those things perceived by the senses which are perceived immediately, or may those things properly be said to be sensible which are perceived immediately, or not without the intervention of others? And Hylas says, I don't know what you're talking about. Tell me more. And so Philonous says, look, when you're reading a book, you perceive the letters, but you don't perceive the meaning, right? The letters, suppose you're reading some book on virtue, right? And so you perceive the letters, but then indirectly you perceive, in quotes, things like virtue, God, and so on. I guess he's, you know, reading some devotional book, right? So he says, what I perceive immediately, which means directly. So every time you see the word immediately, it doesn't mean like right afterwards in time. It means directly. So what I perceive immediately or directly are the letters, but mediately or by means of these are suggested to my mind notions of God, virtue, truth, etc. Now that the letters are truly sensible things or perceived by the sense, there is no doubt. But I want to know whether you agree. And he says, no, God and virtue, they're not sensible. So you see the letters that talk about God and virtue, and then in your mind, that sort of suggests to you the ideas of God and virtue. You see the word God, and then you form the concept of God in your mind. The letters are sensible things, but God's not sensible himself. So the point he's trying to establish here is that sensible things are perceived directly by the senses. And so Hylas agrees. And then he says, talks about sounds. So the middle of 93. Does not follow from this, let's talk about the sky. I see one part of the sky red and another blue, and then my reason concludes there must be some cause of the diversity of colors. Yet it cannot be said to be a sensible thing or perceived by the sense of seeing. So in other words, I see the sky, it's red in one part and blue in another part. I perceive the colors, but I don't perceive the reason why the colors are different. That has to do with my mind. That's an inference. That's not a sensible thing. The cause of the sky being red in one place and blue in another place isn't something I can sense. It's something I might conclude with my reason, but it's not a sensible thing. Okay, he agrees. And then he says, well, what about sound? I hear a variety of sounds, yet I can't be said to hear the causes of those sounds, right? So you hear a clip-clock sound, and you infer that a coach is coming or something, right? That's, you don't, strictly speaking, hear the coach. What you hear is a sound, which you then infer to be a coach. Okay, and he agrees with that. So you get this general principle on 93. Sensible things are those which are immediately perceived by the sense, or directly perceived by the senses. Okay, so then the question is, you know, who is the skeptic? Who doesn't believe in material things? And so, this definition here. So, what are sensible things? Sensible things are those which are directly, immediately perceived by the senses. Which are sounds and colors and shapes and so on, smells. Anybody remember what the word is for this stuff that we talked about earlier when we talked about representationalism?
Sense perception?
Sense perception is another word for it. Sense data. Data of the senses. I was just talking about the sense qualities of objects, not the objects themselves, but their sense qualities. Okay. So then, skip ahead a little bit here. Talk about tastes. There's only going to be two up here. And they talk about color. And you can see Locke's idea of secondary qualities comes out. And when they talk about the tulip. Let me find the tulip here. And 112. Okay, here we go. So, and they go on this long time. You see, Barclay's trying to get him to agree, the Hylas to agree, that sensible things are those things which are perceived directly by the senses. And, there's an earlier thing, too, here about sound. And Locke says, sound is just like
it's a disturbance in the air. And he's like, so sound is a species of motion? And he says, isn't sound what you hear? Like, if I hear a bell chiming, is that like a vibration? A vibration is something you can see or feel. A vibration isn't something you hear. You hear a sound. A vibration is something you can either feel with your body. You can feel a vibration, or maybe you can, or if it's a motion in the air, you can see a motion, but you can't hear motion. And so what you hear is like a ringing. You can hear a sound. And so he says, so you're saying you can see sounds, but you can never hear them. That seems kind of weird, Locke, or Hylas, right? Who's standing for Locke here? But they get to the tulip, and you see Locke's doctrine of substance here. Page 112. So Philonous says near the bottom, make me to understand the difference between what is immediately perceived and a sensation. Okay, so Locke starts talking about sensations of the real material world, which are different from these sensible things. And so Hylas says, the sensation I take to be the act of the mind perceiving, besides which there is something perceived, and this I call the object. For example, there is red and yellow on that tulip. But then the act of perceiving those colors is in me only and not in the tulip. And that goes back to, again, Locke's idea of secondary qualities, right? That color is a secondary quality. The tulip out there in the world doesn't really have a color, but it affects me in a certain way that gives me color sensations that are in my mind. And so Philonous says, what tulip do you speak of? Is it that which you see? The same. And what do you see besides color and figure and extension? Nothing, right? And then that's, and then so Philonous says, would you say then that the red and the yellow are coexistent with the extension? And that's like the extension is just the shape, right? So you have extension means shape. Actually, figure means shape. Extension just means it's sort of that it occupying space or being spread out in space or having size, if you like. So extension is the quality of having some size, and then figure is the particular shape that it takes. So you look at the tulip, right? You see the tulip shape. You see it has certain size. You see it's got these colors in it. Well, where is the real tulip? Right? What do you see besides the tulip? Nothing. Okay? But then Hylas says, but that is not all. I would say that they have a real existence without the mind in some unthinking substance. And then, Philonous comes back and says, that the colors are really in the tulip, which I see, is manifest. Neither can be denied that this tulip may exist in your mind or mine, but that any immediate object of the senses or combination of ideas should exist in some unthinking substance is an evident contradiction. Now, why? And he says, nor can I imagine how this follows from what you just said now, that the red and yellow were in the tulip you saw, since you don't pretend to see that unthinking substance. So he wants to say, look, the red and yellow are in my mind, but the size and shape are out there in the world. Again, primary, secondary qualities, right? There's some material object out there made of molecules or atoms. Locke calls them corpuscles, which he has this sort of vague idea of the fundamental building blocks of matter, which are independent of the mind, which are out there in the world. I have my sense organs that are picking this data up in various different senses. And he says, shape and size, those are real. They're part of the real tulip. But color, that's in me. That's the way the tulip affects my sense organs and consequently my mind. And Berkeley says, well, when you look at the tulip, what do you see besides the shape and the color and the size? So why do you say the color's in your mind, but the shape and the size are out there in the world? It doesn't make any sense. And then Locke says that these things exist in some unthinking substance. And by that he means matter. So the size and the shape, those exist in the unthinking substance of matter. The red and the yellow, those exist in my mind, the colors. And then Hylas says, you have an artful way, Philonous, of diverting our inquiry from the subject. And he says that they're getting off track. And then Philonous says, no, I haven't gone astray at all. We're talking about this idea you have of unthinking substance or matter and thinking substance or ideas in your mind. and or use another word for it, sensible qualities. And what Barclay is trying to get through here is that the tulip is just the red and the yellow and the tulip shape and the tulip smell and all those things put together. That's what a tulip is. That's the real tulip. There is no tulip beyond the sense tulip. That sensible things, to say sensible things exist, means to say that sensible, you have sense of certain sensations in your mind. And that's all there is to it. And that Locke, as an empiricist, is unable to prove this external world of matter. And you can see how over and over again he sort of leads him down the primrose path. What are you looking at? The tulip. You see it? What are you seeing? Shape, color, size. So where is the real tulip? Well, I can't really see the real tulip. I see the shape and the size and so on, and then I infer there's a real tulip out there someplace.
Right.
And then he says, well, how do you get from the tulip in your mind to the tulip in this supposedly real world? Why not just say the tulip you see is a real tulip? And Locke scratches his head says, I think we've gone wrong here someplace, but I'm not sure where, and wants to sort of back up and they go on to some other thing where, again, Barclay kind of leads him through the nose, and then Hylas ends up contradicting himself again. Thoughts? Comments so far? Yeah.
So it sounds like Locke is presuming that if there's a God, he's not an archdeceiver, therefore I can know things. Whereas Barclay is saying there is a God, he's not trying to lead us astray, but knowing things only occurs through him.
Yeah, and I think he would say that knowledge is possible too, but it's knowledge of the world of ideas. And so I think he would reject this idea of the archdeceiver. He would say that the only reason people think there's a world apart from our sensations is through the influence of these skeptical, atheistic philosophers who don't believe in God. Or think that, okay, there is a God, but he doesn't have much to do with the world. He sort of created and left it alone, and then we're left to our own devices. You see this again on 115, where Hylas gives his view one more time. He says, I acknowledge, Philonous, that upon fair observation of what passes in my mind, I can discover nothing else but that I am a thinking being affected by a variety of sensations. Okay, it sounds sort of like Descartes here, right? I'm a thinking thing. Neither is it possible for me to conceive how sensation should exist in an unperceiving substance, okay? So I try to think about a world independent of my mind or of my sensations, and it's sort of hard for me to explain what I mean. But then, on the other hand, when I look on sensible things in a different view, considering them as so many modes and qualities, I find it necessary to suppose a material substratum without which they cannot be conceived to exist. So he says, when I think about, on the one hand, I think, okay, well, how is it that I hear a sound, but then I think about that sound as existing but not being heard? I try to think about a tree following the forest with no one around, and I try to think about it making a sound, right? And I think of it that way, and I think, well, if a tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound? Well, if no one's here there to hear it, then how can there be a sound? And so he thinks, okay, maybe that's one for Barclay, one for Philonous. But he says, on the other hand, when I try to think about, again, come back to the cup, and I try to think, okay, well, there's purpleness and cylindricity and a certain like sound that I make when I click my fingernail on it, and a certain like reflective quality and the purpleness, but there's no real cup that's the cause of all those things. That seems crazy too, and that seems crazier. The idea that there could be a collection of qualities without some substance in which they exist. Because to be a mode of something means to be a property of something. So you can't have the property of purpleness without a thing which is purple. You can't have the property of cylindrical without a thing which is cylindrical. You can't have the property of being made out of plastic without having a thing which is made out of plastic. right? There's the real object's got to be there. You just can't have a bunch of qualities because there's got to be something they're hanging on. That's Locke's argument. And again, it's not an empiricist argument. It's a kind of rationalist argument about, he says, I find it necessary to suppose a material substratum when I think about qualities in this way. Qualities can't exist without an object in which they are a part of. So you had your aunt for a while.
I was basically going to say that basically Berkeley would say that it's impossible for a tree to form a forest when no one is there to hear it, because the tree wouldn't have existed in the first place.
Well, it's a good question about the tree. Actually, let's kind of skip ahead to the... We'll look at that Ronald Knox poem in the middle and see what Berkeley says about the tree.
I think one of the probably clearer explanations of what Berkeley is trying to say about like empiricism is in his explanation about the colors of clouds. When you get up to it, there is no substance at all. But yet, when you stand far enough away from it, it gives you this perception that it's got substance. But when you get up to it, like with if you're looking at a tulip, you get up close enough to it with a microscope, there is no substance to it that we can perceive. It's just this collection of ideas that is giving us this perception of matter. But it's in actuality nothing.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, more visual sensations. So it's not like sort of the macro-micro thing still sort of assumes a material world. He would just say that, you know, that, again, what are you perceiving? You're perceiving shapes and colors and sounds and tastes. You're not perceiving material objects. What you're doing is you have all these perceptions, and then you jump into the rationalist camp, the enemy, right? And you think, okay, I'm having all these sensations, but where do they all come from? Oh, there must be a material world. And I have all these sensations of the cup. What are they hanging on? Oh, it must be like a real cup, which I can never see and can never touch and can never taste, but somehow exists as the cause of all my sensations of touch and taste and color and so on. And so this comes up in when Bologna says, material substratum, this again is Psalm 115. Material substratum, call you it? Pray, by which of your senses came you acquainted with that being? You hear a pin drop, right? And Locke's like, Hylas, right? Again, the caricature of Locke. And he says, it is not itself sensible, its modes and qualities only being perceived by the senses. Again, you can never see the real table. All you can see is shape, size, color. Those are qualities of the real table, which are evident to the senses, the sensible things that they're debating about. And so Philonous says, I presume then it was by your reflection and reason you obtained your idea of it. So he says, okay, you admit that you can't see substance, and Hylas has admitted that. So how'd you get this idea? Well, it must be like it's sort of a priori, right? It's this you reflected on, oh, qualities can exist without being qualities of some object. So I cook up this idea of object that sort of holds all the qualities together or supports them or something. And then Hylas says, I do not pretend to have any positive idea of it. However, I conclude it exists because the qualities cannot be conceived to exist without a support. And this gets into this argument about support and the infinite regress. But again, you get this, I know not what, which supports qualities. Where Locke says, when you try to explain what matter is, you just sort of, you're like a child who's trying to explain something they don't understand. We don't have any, you know, it's sort of this vague, hazy notion of like all these sensations we have, and then there's like the stuff that's causing the sensations, but we don't have any positive idea of it. It's just sort of a placeholder. And so then he comes up with this infinite regress idea that we just talked about, that if substance supports qualities, it's got to be spread out underneath it. The substance is underneath the qualities, spread out under it, holding it up. Sort of like, think about like a pyramid of cheerleaders or something, right? The bottom row is holding the rest up. Or like a table, right? A table holding up the books. But then what's the table is substance and it needs support. And so it's got another substance underneath it, and you go back to infinity, and you end up with this absurdity. And so so he says that since the whole concept, you know, this is supposed to be an a priori concept, but if an a priori concept deduced from logic ends up in a contradiction, you know, get rid of it, right? It doesn't make any sense. And so he's established you can't perceive it with the senses, and when you try to make sense of it as an a priori concept, you end up in these contradictions and paradoxes. Well, let's go to that poem by Ronald Knox then. Let's see. Oh, by the way, they talk about this concept of reflection, ideas of reflection, which I don't think I talked about last week. These are ideas in Locke that come from the mind reflecting its own operations. So for Locke, an idea of reflection is like the idea of will or making a decision. You don't get that idea from kind of looking at individual sensations. You can't. Locke couldn't figure out how you get the idea of will, or the idea of idea, or the idea of thought, or the idea of concept, right? The concept of a concept. So he says, what happens is you have this kind of inner sensation where you reflect on your mind's own operations, and you get these abstract concepts of idea and thought and will and doubt and so on. And so that's what Locke means when he's talking about reflection. I think when Berkeley says, "Oh, you must have come about it through these ideas of reflection," he's you know, using Locke's terminology and says, "Okay, well, you see, there's only two kinds of ideas, Locke: ideas of sensation, ideas of reflection, and it's not going to fit your concept of substance can't come from either one of these." So therefore, it doesn't exist. Did you have your hand up?
Yeah. So if Berkeley disagrees with Locke's idea of material matter being supported by something, what do you think he would think about like our planet being suspended in what most people perceive to be empty space?
Well, he would say, you know, you have certain perceptions, right, of like, if you're out in the space capsule, you have an experience of like the round Earth, and I suppose it was distant stars or something. Are you saying that the Earth existing apart, that shows the Earth exists apart from our minds or something?
Well, so the whole concept that Locke talks about is that everything needs some sort of support, right? And Berkeley is disagreeing with that fact, saying that if you have this infinity of basically support, it uh-huh. just creates a paradox.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, with that said, like, your desk is supported by the ground, which has been supported by the Earth.
Oh, okay.
The Earth is not supported by anything as we can perceive it, other than what we understand to be gravity or the sun. Right,
so yeah, I mean, he would agree. He would say, look, if you have something supporting something else, then that makes sense, right? He would say, you know, if everything is sitting on the Earth, and if the table's on the Earth, and the Earth's sort of, I suppose, hanging in empty space, I see what you mean, so what's the Earth hanging on? I'm not sure what he would say about that. He might say that, I mean, he might just say that this whole idea that the Earth hangs in the middle of empty spaces is, you know, maybe not supportable. I don't know. It's an interesting question. People think about what would Berkeley say about that for next time. I don't think we have a chance to get to the pup. I think we'll start out with that. So what would Berkeley say about, you know, the Earth hanging in empty space? Does this violate his idea that one thing has to be supported by another? For next time. And then we'll start out with this poem by Ronald Knox on page 128 and talk about what happens to the books in my study when I leave the room. Do they just pop in out of existence or what? On Wednesday.